This is continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh from True Crime Today.
Welcome back to the coverage. We are now on to segment three in our coverage today. Let's go straight to the courtroom.
Mr. Griffin?
Thank you. Good morning, Ms. Seckinger.
Good morning.
I want to first just go to June. I want to go to June the 7th when you were up in Alec Murdaugh's office and you were talking to him about the Ferris attorney fee money, correct?
Correct.
And while you were in the midst of this conversation, he received a telephone call informing him that his father was being readmitted back to the hospital, correct?
That was my understanding, yes.
And his father had just gotten out of the hospital either that Saturday or Sunday, right?
I don't know.
Okay, and do you know that he spent the Friday night in the hospital with his dad?
I don't know.
Do you, his father was Randolph Murdaugh, who was one of the principals of that law firm, correct?
I know who his father was, yes.
Was he a principal of the law firm?
He was previously. He wasn't at the time of his death.
Was he beloved by the partners in the law firm?
Yes.
And his father, and when Alec got the phone call that his father was going back into the hospital, and you mentioned that, you know, the belief was that it was terminal.
Correct.
You stopped your work and turned into a friend, right?
That's correct.
Provided him sympathy, correct?
That's correct.
And backed off of what you were doing to allow him to whatever he was going to do with his father, right?
That's right.
And so when you walked out of the office, things had come to a standstill as to your investigation through Alec directly as to where's the Ferris fee money, right?
That's right.
And Mr. Randolph Murdaugh passed away. Monday was the 7th. He passed away on the 10th, I believe, didn't he?
I'm not sure of the date, but that sounds right.
That Thursday, right? And if Alec had stayed out of the office from the day that, from that Monday when he got a phone call that his dad was going back in the hospital in terminal until his dad passed, and shortly after he passed, I mean, no one would have said a thing in that firm, would they?
I'm not sure if they would have not.
Okay. Now, what you were looking at, investigating, was where is the fee due to the law firm on the Ferris case, right?
That's right.
And that was a case where Alec was associated with Chris Wilson, and they represented plaintiff, I assume, Mr. Ferris or Ms. Ferris or the state of Ferris.
Correct.
And they got an excellent result as during the case. It was a verdict, a non-jury verdict after a trial in Richland County. You remember that?
I don't know the details of the case. Okay.
The firm got an expense check, but no fee check, and the immediate question went out to Chris Wilson's paralegal, where's the fee for the law firm, correct?
That's right.
And the paralegal said, our bosses got paid, and then that caused you to look into the matter.
That's right.
Okay. Now, and Alec told you, no, the money is still in Chris Wilson's trust account, right?
That's right.
And he said that to you on multiple occasions?
That's right.
And in fact, Chris Wilson sent an email saying the money's in my trust account.
He did in July.
In July, that was forwarded on to you, right?
That's right.
And I noticed, well, let me back up. Did Alec explain, did he come up with a story to explain, well, the reason the money is in the trust account is because I'm considering whether to structure the fee?
We did discuss that, okay. Yes.
And in that law firm, your law firm that you're an employee of, partners have structured attorney's fees in the past, correct?
They have.
And so the fact that, and just so the record is clear, when we're talking about structuring attorney's fees, it is delaying the payment of the fees through some financial product. Isn't that correct?
That's right.
And by delaying the payment of the fees through a financial product, if successful, it allows to delay the payment of taxes on that money.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, in the times that the fees have been structured in the past, when the payment of the fees have been delayed, who is the beneficiary of the financial product? Is it the partner that brought the fee to the firm, or is it the law firm?
So we've only done it once or twice in the past, and when it was done, it was the beneficiary was the partner, but it was also contributed and figured into our allocation at the fee breakdown at the end of the year.
Okay. So there's no, I mean, the fact that there's a structure the time you did it, when it was disclosed above board, it is, and just use, say, $100,000 fee, for example. I mean, to allocate it to the firm, that partner who delayed receiving $100,000 till sometime in the future would still have to put his 7.5% or her 7.5% into the kitty of the firm.
Right, and that would also be a percentage of the money that he received. That'd be taken into account of that.
Well, would it? I mean, if it was $100,000?
Yes, it did.
So he got credit on, or she got credit for the $100,000, even though it never went to the firm?
Yes.
Okay. So if a partner...
If a partner did it correctly, it would be recognized, and it would be accounted for correctly. The question wasn't whether he was going to structure a fee. It was whether he had received the fee personally.
Understand. And he had said he had it, and it was at Chris Wilson's office.
That's what he stated.
Now, the spreadsheet and the files that you were asked about, I noticed the Ferris matter wasn't on any of them, correct?
That's right.
And the Ferris matter wasn't on any of them because the Ferris matter, the firm ultimately got paid $792,000, which was what the firm was owed on the Ferris case.
We did.
And after Maggie and Paul's murder, and after Mr. Randolph's death, murder on the 7th, Mr. Randolph Murdoch's death on the 10th, how long of a delay was there before you got in touch with Lee Cope and Lee reached out to Chris Wilson?
There wasn't a delay in me getting in touch with Lee Cope. Lee Cope knew about it. The decision was made to call me off of it, and now Lee would deal with it from there with Chris Wilson.
Okay, so as far as you know, there was no delay. It was just taken over by Lee Cope.
There wasn't a delay on my part. It was taken over by Lee Cope.
And you don't know whether Lee, how long it took Lee to, Lee Cope to reach out?
You would have to ask Lee.
And so, and you can't testify to that. We would have to ask Lee, right?
Yeah, I don't know.
And then you would, talked about a Hershberger case where there was what appeared on paper to be a structured fee, correct?
That's right.
And you're having done one in the past, it did not appear that that the proper procedures were followed so that Alec would have to pay income tax on it.
That's
whether
correct.
It's structured or not.
That's correct.
And in his explanation, I think you said that was back in
late May, early June.
Yeah, that check is May 12, 2021, the Hershberger.
I can't be sure when the exact conversations were. They were all going on around the same time, but it had been after that check.
Okay. And that, and so the thought there was, and Alec told you that, well, I'm just trying to sort of shelter money from me, put in Maggie's name because I'm being a defendant in the voting case.
That's correct.
Now you and your firm, and you've had outside forensic accountants looking at everything, and you don't have any information or evidence or documents that would suggest that any of the Hershberger fee went into Maggie's name.
I did not pursue that portion of it. We have testimony from Michael Gunn that there was no annuity set up.
Right, and I guess, right, so as far as you can tell Judge Newman here today is that Alec put that money in a fake Forge account that was Alec Murdoch doing business as Forge.
Correct.
And you don't have any information that money then went into Maggie Murdoch's investment account, personal account, or any sort of account, right?
I know that it went into his Forge account. After that, I don't know how it was used.
And I think you said that that you didn't start back up and looking into the Hershberger matter until sometime in, I think you said, did not readdress it until late September.
That's correct.
Okay. And early September, you were sitting in your office and you had a epiphany or, just a thought. Well, let's just see what how many times Alec's been, his cases have checks going to Forge.
Well, when you're speaking of epiphany, I had started digging through his client list for every fee that he'd brought in. And rather than going one by one, my epiphany was, let me just run a payment ledger on Forge and see what that turns up, rather than digging one by one.
Okay. And what prompted you to do that?
Because I was trying to look to see if there had been any more settlements that had been written to Forge like this other one with Hershberger so that we could account for them and discuss how we were going to handle them at the year end with the bonus distribution.
I see. And at what time of the year do you have to prepare final reports for the
December.
Partners? For December. And when do you start working on that?
It depends every year, but usually December.
But in September, you were, doing your job, trying to see if there were other Hershberger-type structures out there.
That's right.
Okay. And so you ran a report of financial records that were maintained at the law firm, correct?
Correct.
These were electronic records?
Yes.
And you didn't have to order bank statements for anyone. You had them right there on your computer system?
I have mine, yes.
Okay. And there's nothing that happened in, let me back up. We've seen checks to Forge, I think you said, going back to 2015?
Correct.
Have those checks been on the firm financial system and maintained them since 2015?
They were. They didn't catch our attention before that.
Okay. And there's nothing about the murder of Maggie and Paul that prevented you from accessing that information at any point in time, is there?
No, what prevented me was work and personal obligations to get to that point in time to have the opportunity to look.
And the but the information had been at your fingertips. Anything that was done in 2015, it was there. 16, it was there. 17, it was there.
That's right.
And that's why you were able to go back and do the work, and law firm stood up and made these clients whole. Is that right?
That's right.
Now, do you have the summary exhibit 314 up there?
I do not.
I may have it right here. Well, I guess I can put on Mr. Elmo here. It's not my favorite animal, but well, let me just have you look at this right quick. Can you go through Exhibit 314 and there the grand total is $2,841,512.55 and tell us just identify anyone on this list that is just straight diversion of fees that were due to the law firm?
Both Hirschbergers were straight diversions of fees that were due.
Is there any other one on here?
Partials of some of the other ones. I can't remember the breakdowns, but I know like Elise Mallory or one of those two. Some of them should have been firm's fees due to them.
Right. But all the other ones, but the Hirschberger matter, involve proceeds that should have gone to the client, right?
Which your client stalled, yes.
Right. And that, well, you investigated it and you came to that conclusion and the law firm came to that conclusion, right?
Yes.
Okay. But as part of the investigation, did you have to interview the clients and ask the client, hey, did you authorize Alec to put this in a fake forge account?
We did interview the clients, most of them. We met with them. Most of them were very surprised and shocked and stated that they had no idea that they had been stolen from.
And so to establish that the clients didn't authorize Alec to do what he did, I mean, you had to go to the clients.
Correct.
And get their response.
Correct.
And you accepted their response, rightfully so, correct?
Correct.
On this list of 314, is there anyone where you didn't go to the client or the client representative, except perhaps Hirschberger, and say, did you authorize Alec to do this?
I might not have met personally with all of them, but somebody within our firm did.
Right, okay. Right. Now, Barrett, the second one, Barrett Bulwer, said took insurance proceeds, and that's Exhibit 314. And I think you said Alec had power of attorney?
He did.
And was Mr. Bulwer alive in 2018?
I don't remember.
And how is it that you know that Alec did not have permission from Barrett Bulwer to keep that money personally, that perhaps Mr. Bulwer had owed him some money?
When I believe Ronnie Crosby's the one who spoke with Jarrett Boulware, who is his PR, so that'd be a better suited question for Ronnie than it would be for me.
So we would need Ronnie Crosby and Jarrett Boulware to come in and testify as to what Barrett Boulware may or may not have agreed to do without.
You may have one that he could come in and testify that to, but the rest of these on these lists, people told me that they either did not know about it, it was covered up, or it was forged.
And they would need to come in and tell the
they
court.
They would, and they have.
Oh, they've testified?
They believe they have.
Not in this proceeding?
Not in this proceeding.
Now, there was another group of cases that involved Palmetto State Bank, is that correct?
That's right.
And your brother-in-law?
That's right.
And again, there's Arthur Badger, Natasha Thomas, Hakeem Pinckney. Do you know if Mr. Lafitte or anyone at the bank was personal representative or conservator for any of these folks?
He was conservator for Natasha Thomas. I believe he was conservator for Hakeem Pinckney. I can't remember the exact circumstance. And he was the conservator for Arthur Badger's wife.
Okay. And Mr. Lafitte, I mean, all of these checks went to Palmetto State Bank, correct?
Correct.
And then from Palmetto State Bank, they were sent out to pay, according to your investigation, expenses that Alec owed. Is that right?
Correct.
And repayment of loans that Alec owed, right?
Correct.
And that Mr. Lafitte was knowledgeable about that, as far as you know, right?
Appeared to be.
Now, I want to go into a little bit more detail on some of these. Let's just go to, I'm going to put it up on this Elmo, and it is the Ben Allen Kendall. Well, that's Hirschberg, but let's don't do that. Let's do the next one, Adriana. And let's see if I can do this right. It's, do you see that one? That's the disbursement sheet?
Yes.
And the recovery amount here is, and it says settlement proceeds to Forge Consulting, and that's $225,000?
Correct.
And that, according to this document, represents what the client should have gotten and didn't get.
Correct. Okay.
And then the attorney's fees here said $22,000. Is that the firm got $22,000?
Yes.
Okay. And then this same exhibit, there's a lengthy footnote down here. I guess, does this footnote explain what happened?
Yes, it does.
In this footnote, it says there were three previous disbursements in this matter. Is that right?
Yes.
And it says the first one occurred on December 13th, 2018, issuing attorney's fees and costs $19,932.89 to Palmetto State Bank, satisfying loans and et cetera, and other matters. Is that right?
That's correct.
Now, do we know if any of those are fake bills?
They look to be illegitimate.
Did you confirm they were legitimate?
Yes.
And how'd you do that?
By looking at the paperwork and observing the paperwork.
Okay. And then here, there was another disbursement on December 20th, 2018. Is that right?
That's right.
And this document referenced some exhibits. There's an exhibit A through F. I don't believe that's attached. I mean, it may be. I don't have it. Did you prepare this footnote?
I'm not. I don't remember which ones exactly I prepared. I've prepared a lot of them, and Chelsea Vant prepared a lot of them as well.
So, and most all of these have an explanation and a footnote as to what the entire transaction was
about.
That's
right.
Okay. And you didn't do every single one. It was a team effort, I take it.
That's right.
And so people on the team investigated it and then would have to come in here and explain exactly what they did and what they learned. And
that's correct. It's also been through forensic audit and also looked at former FBI, and it's been provided to law enforcement, who all looked over it as well.
Okay. All right. Now, I think you also said that on back to June the 7th, that you said that Alec called you and asked for his updated balance in his 401k.
That's right.
And he told you he was putting together some financial records for civil discovery in the voting case, and there was a hearing coming up.
Yes.
And that he had asked you, he'd questioned you previously about the balance in the 401k.
That's right. It's not been the first time.
And the times that he questioned you, was it in the context of putting together information for the voting case, or just he was curious?
Putting together information for financials.
Okay. Financials in general, or financials in the voting case, or you just don't know?
I didn't really ask particulars.
So
the perception was that it's for the voting case. Talk in the office, we knew hearings were coming up. We knew they were looking for his financials.
Okay. Well, when you said on the 7th he called you about financials, did he reference the voting case?
I believe he did.
Okay. Now, Do you know what impact or what consequences Alec would have suffered from his partners if he had just, or if you had found that he had diverted the Ferris fee to himself personally, as opposed to putting it in a structure or putting it in the firm? Do you know?
I think that he probably would have had some bad repercussions for him because they were adamant that we were not going to be part of having any portion of hiding or diverting any fees.
And the concern was hiding fees from the civil discovery in the Bowdoin case?
Yes, at that point in time it was.
And that wasn't, and that, at that point in time, no one was saying that they thought he was stealing from the firm, but that he was sheltering money from being disclosed.
That was the opinion, yes.
And then it wasn't until September when you ran a report and you saw all these forged checks being deposited in the Bank of America account and endorsed by Alec, you'd seen his signature, that you realize there's been something far different going on than what anyone believed. Is that
that's
right?
That's correct.
And that's what led to his resignation or termination.
Correct. Okay.
And that information had been in the books and records of the law firm since 2015.
Correct.
Okay. One last question. The information that in part of the investigation where you and members of your staff and the forensic accountants determined that the clients did not authorize any of these transactions? I mean, you have no personal knowledge other than what's been told to you by people working for you or by the clients, right?
I also saw some of the deposits going into his personal Bank of America account statements.
No, I understand that, but whether the clients...
If they had some back deal, I don't know about any of it, no.
Right, right. Any information you have about what the clients told the firm is hearsay, as far as you know.
It's not hearsay if they said it to me.
Okay. And some said it to you?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Very briefly, Your Honor. One thing you know is that the money that you've talked about for the fake forge went into an account Richard Alexander Murdaugh DBA forged, correct?
Correct.
Is there any possible legitimate explanation for client trust funds to go into that account?
No.
And after you realized that they went into those accounts, did the firm ultimately refund the money to those clients?
Yes.
You mentioned that you actually found in his office some bank statements for that particular account. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And we'll show you what's been marked as Exhibit 335. Have you take a look at it? Is that consistent with the Richard Alexander Murdaugh DBA fake forge account that you saw?
Yes.
That you had repeated instances of client trust money going into?
Yes.
That there's no possible legitimate explanation for?
That's correct.
You were asked some questions about the manner of your inquiry and that sort of thing. And I want to take you back a little bit further very quickly. Do you remember, is it common for, after the books get cleared at the end of the year, for certain partners to loan money to the firm to handle operating expenses until fees start to come in?
It is. Basically, we wipe out all the cash reserves. So in order to operate for the first couple of months, attorneys will loan money to the firm for operating expenses.
At some point in time prior to all of this, did you become aware of an instance in which Alec Murdaugh had erroneously received a repayment that was actually meant for his brother, Randy?
We did.
All right. And that did that happen once or did the same thing happen twice?
It actually went through twice. The check was written to him erroneously, and within a few days, he brought the check back to my staff and had it recut to him. So the first check that was recut was held for him for about a year. So the replacement check went through immediately, and the first check cleared about a year later. And that's when we discovered that going back and looking, that I discovered that he was paid erroneously, that it should have been Randolph Murdoch and not R. Alexander Murdoch.
So it was one repayment, but he managed to get it twice.
That's right.
How much was that check roughly, do you recall?
$125,000 roughly.
$125,000. Was he confronted about this when that was discovered?
Yes.
What was his explanation?
His explanation was that it was an accident, that he thought it was due to him and that he didn't know, and that he found the other one later and deposited it too because he thought they were due to him.
Okay. And was he required to pay that money back?
Yes.
And after he gave that explanation of, oops, I didn't realize these $225,000 checks were for me, was that matter then forgotten or moved on from?
It was shelved, yes.
It was shelved. Nothing, no repercussions happened at that point in time or anything like
no.
that? Okay. So the money gets paid back and people moved on. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. You testified before that when the murders happened, that the inquiry, nobody was going to bring that up now in the wake of the murders, the Ferris fees that you had talked to Alec about the morning that Maggie and Paul were killed, correct?
That's right. It's a family-like place. Everybody was concerned for him, his family. We knew we had time to discuss this before the end of the year, and at that point, like we said, we didn't think he was stealing any money from us.
They had no reason at that time to think he was stealing, correct?
That's right.
And so it did get shelved, correct?
That's correct.
All right. And then in July, you got an email. Is that correct?
That's right.
And you testified to this before. What did the email say from Chris Wilson's office?
It said that the money was in the account available to us at any time that we would ask.
And then so at that point, the money seemed like it was there. The money had is not missing, and so the matter was shelved. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Right. However, you've testified that things have been going on for a while, and it was months later that triggered you to do that inquiry. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay. Because there had been multiple instances over the years. Is that right?
That's right.
But that has nothing to do the fact that that might have occurred regardless of, at any point in time because of all the things that have been going on. That has nothing to do with the fact that when things were happening in June, they got shelved, and then you found out the money was there and you thought that matter was closed. Is that correct?
That's right. We never knew about the prior. We had no reason to look. We had no complaints from clients. We had nobody saying they were missing money. And this just turned up when we started searching because of the Hirschberger and the other relevant things.
Has there been instances in which Alec used the firm credit card for personal expenses and was required to pay that back?
Yes.
And if the money got paid back, well, then everybody moved on. Is that right?
That's right.
So there was a history of that.
That's right.
You get the money back in, and everybody moves on. Is
that's
that correct?
That's right. History of trust and brotherhood.
And that's what happened in July with the Ferris fees. Is that correct?
That's right.
You were asked about whether or not you were told in July that the money was in Chris Wilson's trust account. That's what you were told. Is that correct?
Correct.
Have you come to find out, however, that it actually had not been there?
We did.
And you found this check proving it, correct?
That's correct.
Bottom line is that there had been a long history of if the money got paid back, people would move on, correct?
That's right.
Things were continuing to percolate. They got delayed in June because of everything that happened, correct?
Correct.
But you were now curious, and eventually, months later, you look back at that. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And that also was highlighted and sparked by the discovery of the check proving that he had not been telling the truth the entire time.
Correct.
Thank you. Nothing further.
Anything further?
There you go.
All right. Thank you. You may step down. Well, we're running up on lunchtime. Mr. Waters, what's next?
Well, we can certainly continue with this. We have Annette Griswold, who is Alec's former paralegal, who in large measure will testify to the similar events with Thomas Moore Hirschberger and the Ferris fees. Again, I don't want to be cumulative for purposes of this, but she will certainly add to that. We also have available on this particular issue Michael Gunn, who is the principal in Forge, who of course will testify that he had never had any discussion with Alec about structuring fees, or at least nothing had ever been set up, and that this account is not his, and that all the money in these various transactions never went to him, and that they were diverted. And then we have Chris Wilson as well, who can describe the circumstances of those Ferris fees. All that would be very lengthy, but we have all of that available in as much as that's necessary to complete the story for purposes of the in-camera hearing. We do have, though, we have arranged to get additional SLED and other witnesses here related outside of this for the afternoon, if you wish to make use of the jury for that. And also, as it relates to this, and we're also prepared to offer testimony about these particular instances, but we do have a confession of judgment that I would offer to the court at this point in time in the Satterfield case. And again, before the jury, we would have testimony about that, but for purposes of clear and convincing evidence, we have this confession of judgment that we would offer for purposes of this hearing as well. In addition, we have his disbarment from the Supreme Court, which also refers to his admissions of financial misconduct, which we believe also are relevant to the court's decision at this point as to whether or not there is clear and convincing evidence established of these various other crimes. And so we would offer those as well to the court for its consideration now. However, we can certainly offer testimony about those aspects as well. I think, Your Honor, if we can get to a decision point on the law firm witnesses, then we can move forward. Again, we have some witnesses related to Satterfield that we could address and try to work that in over the next few days of court time. And then finally, with the boat case as well. And so that would be some of the financial witnesses that we would offer. And then finally, Your Honor, we do have some witnesses from Palmetto State Bank who will talk about the extent of Alec Murdoch's financial condition at the time the murders happened and the reason why, explaining the reason why all these things were occurring and why they were all coming to a head in June of 2021.
Mr. Griffin.
Your Honor, I think there's more than enough in the record from this witness to establish that this evidence is not admissible under 404B. And I mean, without even getting to whether they can prove it up by clear and convincing evidence. I'm happy to make that argument at any point in time. But if the whole landscape that he just talked about, Your Honor, 403 also includes a component of undue delay. And as he just described, all the financial misdeeds or crimes that he wants to prove up, we're going to be here until end of February, I suspect, or March, because that's adding 2 weeks to this trial.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. And obviously, as I even pointed out with this witness, we're trying to streamline the presentation. Frankly, the extent of misappropriation is very, very broad, and we're trying to focus on just a few areas. And the ones that we're focusing on are the ones that really came out of his mouth within seconds of law enforcement being on the scene, within seconds of the 911 call happening. And that is, of course, the boat case. And what does that mean? There's two things that are very temporally connected with this particular crime, and that is the confrontation with Ms. Seckinger that morning over the Ferris fees that have been percolating for a while, and then number two is that pending hearing that very week in the boat case, which again, the purpose of that hearing is to, in a specific request for production and interrogatory, to identify all accounts.
And again, once you do that, once those accounts are identified, just like Ms. Seckinger was able to do, just like law enforcement was able to do, the state grand jury was able to do, it doesn't take long to figure all that out and then lead to not only what's happened here, his disbarment, but also, you know, I don't have to get into this specifically, but 99 counts for which he's facing a possible sentence of life without parole on that alone. And so that kind of consequence that's hanging out there is very much relevant and very timely to what was going on June the 7th in his life. The defense asked the question, can you think of any reason? And all of this going on in his life, which is a stellar series of events like nothing ever seen, is certainly relevant for the jury to consider when they consider a perfect storm that was arriving for this man on June the 7th.
Griffin, the witnesses that are here, Ms. Griswold, Chris Wilson, and Mike, Mr. Gunn, the confession of judgment and the disbarment, do you contest the matters which they are here to testify concerning?
It depends on how far they go with their testimony, but I'd certainly, you know, that's predicate for Mr. Gunn to testify. Those, they didn't have an account at Bank of America, and those checks were not deposited with us, and I didn't know anything about this. I mean, that we're acceptable to that, and just, you know, without knowing the full scope of what they intend to offer, it's hard to say yes, but that's all. I mean, just like this witness, I mean, she has a lot of information that is that she learned through investigation. But if we had to try this case, you know, 90% of it she couldn't testify to.
Your Honor, I'd point out that those witnesses that I mentioned, as well as every single one of those victims, all testified. You know, there is transcripts on that, which the defense has had, which, you know, Your Honor has access to as well. So I don't know that necessarily it needs to all be repeated for Your Honor's determination now, because again, as he just said, you know, those facts have been testified to. It's just a question of the parameters for this particular trial, which again, the state's intent is not to try 100 white-collar cases in the context of this murder case. It's only to explain to the jury enough of what was going on in an unfathomable set of events for a lawyer, what was going on in his life that were all coming to a head on June 7th. I think that's extremely relevant, and we plan to do so in a very expedited and focused fashion.
Your Honor, I would say for purposes of the trial, going forward with the jury, I mean, we're not stipulating to any facts.
Yes, sir. Well,
but for purposes of hearing, I'm very candid with the court.
Yes, sir. As far as the court's view of things and what the court needs to determine to be convinced that clear and convincing evidence exists. You know, clear and convincing evidence is not proof beyond a reasonable doubt and all that. It says that degree of proof which will give me a firm belief as to the facts sought to be proven. And if those specific facts are not being contested, what the communication with Ms. Griswold that's in the record, with Chris Wilson, there may be Attorney Wilson, may be some dispute, I don't know. Mr. Gunn, you know, Forge is a well-known consulting firm, and and the Bank of America account says Richard A. Murdaugh, sole proprietor, DBA Forge. Confession of judgment, disbarment. You know, I'm happy to sit and hear any and all of the testimony. You know, one of the things that did occur in the Siegel case was the judge who got reversed didn't want to spend time listening and hearing all of the evidence because of the expediency of things. And the court says, although we sympathize with the court's concern about the length and complexity of the trial. We nevertheless conclude that the importance of the evidence, due to the importance of the evidence, it must be presented and the court must receive it. So I am happy to do that without needless presentation of evidence twice, more than once. And now, I understand the defense's position, and I'm not seeking any waiver on the question of whether or not this should be admitted or not admitted. I know you each have your arguments on regarding 404 issues, and I haven't heard much argument on the race gesta issue, which is equally important, or perhaps more important. But if you are interested in contesting the nature of each one of these witnesses' testimony, if they're here and available, we can hear them. I mean, we can. You indicate that there are some other witnesses on other matters that can occupy the jury for a bit of time this afternoon?
Yes, sir. After our discussion this morning, we got some folks rolling, and after lunch hour, I think we can take us through the end of the day with witnesses that don't relate to this specific issue.
We can go in that direction and then resume with this with more witnesses later this afternoon, tomorrow morning, tomorrow afternoon. I just don't want the jury to sit and to be in an idle format. To the extent that you all can be in agreement with a path forward, that's best. If you can't, then I make the call.
Your Honor, as I mentioned earlier, I strongly believe that based on what you've heard thus far, it doesn't meet the elements of 404B, and you don't need to get to whether it's been proven up by clear and convincing. I mean, if you rule against us on that, then we have to.
How about res gestae?
Well, the only thing that would come close to res gestae is tomato, tomato, right? And so the only thing that comes close to that is, you know, the encounter on June the 7th by this witness up there about the Ferris matter. It's on one matter. It's the Chris Wilson co-counsel fee issue. And that was the only thing he was confronted about in the afternoon before the murders. And
but the state has to prove the state of mind of the defendant,
right,
not solely what this witness knew at that moment in time, but what the defendant knew that was subject to exposure.
And so, Your Honor, in the with regard to the res gestae issue, we had briefed State v. King 334 SC 504, and that is somewhat similar in that it involved thefts for someone stealing money, and there were remote thefts, and there was a theft the night before or close in time to the murders. And the claim was that the murders were done to get money from the victim, and that we had thefts earlier in the day or the day previous, and then number of thefts months and years before.
Did the judge do the 403 analysis, 403, 404 analysis in King?
Well, the trial judge allowed it in. The Supreme Court, Justice Burnett in 1999, overturn Judge Hicks Harwell for admitting the evidence.
Without conducting a 404 analysis, 403 analysis?
Well, I mean, they have a footnote in there.
You have to do what we're doing now.
Yes, sir. But in the case, they said, while the remote thefts may have been minimally relevant to show motive under law, the prejudicial effect of this evidence far outweighed the slight probative value. So the Supreme Court did a 403 analysis. And that's in footnote 5, Your Honor.
Anything else before we break? We'll resume at we'll resume at 2 o'clock with at 2:15 with witnesses, and we will resume with witnesses and the jury witnesses, and we'll resume with this in camera hearing involving witnesses later.
Yes, sir.
So be in recess at 2:15.
That wraps up segment 3 of coverage in the trial of Alec Murdoch for today. Still two more segments to go in the afternoon of testimony. We'll have that for you here in just a moment. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.